Here's the thing. It's not that the town itself is, like, you know, for being in the middle of nowhere is, like, pretty and stuff. It's just I got that fucking small town meth vibe, like, the moment I rolled into town. But
all right.
The show was actually really good, and they really liked me, so I might be going back to Hammett at some point.
Unless I hear this.
Yeah. Nah. We were, like, making meth jokes. They know who they are.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. With me, as usual, is my regular co-host, Keith Foster from San Diego, California.
That's right. I'm fresh off some technical snafus last week, and hopefully this week should go much better. With me is my co-host, Cassidy Robinson from Los Angeles, California.
Indeed. Yes, we had issues last week.
Yeah. It was, thank you, audience, if you mm-hmm. listened, for bearing with us. Mm-hmm. That was more, I think that was more of an episode of Hack Thought than it was Jabber and the Drone, to be honest.
I think you're probably right. I had about 2 hours of audio, and I managed to cut about an hour of stuff that was like, this has nothing to do with movies. But yes, if anybody enjoyed the last episode and would like to hear it the way it was intended to be heard, check out Mike Fallick's podcast, Hack Thought / Let's Start a Cult. And
is he posting the unabridged version?
Yes. But yeah.
But anyway, boring technical shit aside, yeah. We're back this week. We've got movie reviews loaded in the movie canon.
Yes, we're going to review the new horror film Hereditary. And at the
fuck
end
you for that, by the way.
You're welcome. And by the end of the podcast, very horror themed episode, unintentionally, Train to Busan.
For those of you who were like, where the fuck is the Netflix homework last week? It's this week.
Yes, I recorded a little dealio at the end to tell people to listen to this one. But we are going to talk about the zombie movie Train to Busan. So we'll do that. And just to get us started, a little warm up. We did another survey on our Facebook, facebook.com/jabberpodcast. If you want to follow us there, see when we post survey questions to our listeners. Sometimes I also put it on Twitter @JabberPodcast. Sometimes I don't. And sometimes my Facebook is really, really slow. Where's my phone?
You might when you read them, I'll read them.
Yeah.
Go ahead. The survey question was, what was the first R-rated movie you remember seeing in theaters? Hillary Stevens says, my best friend's mom took us to see Schindler's List in the theater because she thought it was important we saw it. I'm really glad she did. I just was 14, so that's something. Yeah, I think that's, you know, that to me makes sense. Like,
sure.
I'm actually sort of surprised, like, movies like that are rated R. I mean, I guess it's...
I mean, you know, if you're just talking about, like, stuff, violence and being disturbing and stuff. I know one of the reasons... the movie was black and white is because it probably would have been NC-17 otherwise.
Oh, due to blood?
Yeah, just for the sheer amount of
you know, I've never seen it.
Carnage. It's not a fun movie. It's tough.
Yeah,
there's some really, really good performances in it, though. That was pretty much the movie that made Ralph Fiennes.
Sure. Yeah. All right. Next, Chris McElprang says, my dad took some friends of mine and me to see Starship Troopers.
That is such a dad to go see movie. Like,
yeah.
You sneak you into a dirty-ish movie that's mostly made for kids.
It's got violence and it's got boobs and it's got
giant bugs.
Yeah. Actually, There was a friend of mine who stayed over at my house one weekend. It was like a Friday night thing. Mm-hmm. And we rented that movie. Our parents let us rent it because we were definitely too young to rent it. It was my parents who they let me watch basically whatever I wanted.
Yeah.
But he was super Mormon and has super Mormon family. So he was not allowed to watch movies like that. And he was thrilled by it.
I bet he was.
I mean, it's a great fucking movie. It is schlock, campy, Paul Verhoeven at his Verhoevenest. I love that movie.
Yeah, it has a huge cult following now. I think the movie did okay-ish back when it came out, but yeah, it's a lot of fun. And it's, you know, like a lot of Verhoeven movies, I think it was totally misunderstood during its time. Everyone thought it was like a for real jingoistic, like, hoorah army kind of movie. And now,
no, watching it's it years so, later, it's like,
satirical. Yeah.
Yeah, it's so subversive. It's that's funny.
Mm-hmm.
Alex Kozaya says The Matrix.
Yeah, that's kind of later down the. I mean, I guess not too much later. A couple years.
I mean, that's a respectable answer. That came out in what, 99?
Mm-hmm.
So we would have been in what, like ninth grade,
eighth or ninth grade? Yeah,
that's like the appropriate age for us to have like snuck into an R-rated movie. And I used to work at a movie theater, and like. You know, if like a 16-year-old or a 17-year-old was trying to get into an R-rated movie, as long as he wasn't being a fucking weirdo about it, you know, like I wasn't going to ID people
right
to get into rated R movies. And The Matrix, I think, is like the perfect example of a movie like that.
No, yeah, no, I agree with that, basically. Yeah. I ended up seeing it way later on DVD, but, you know, that's neither here nor there.
Yeah, well, you weren't really able to see rated R movies for, like, a long time.
You know, I mean, it seemed like the worst thing in the world when I was a kid, but now thinking about it, it's like, I was, like, 14. That's about right. Like...
Oh, when you started... Yeah, I was probably too
when
young.
When the Berlin Wall of me watching R-rated movies was lifted.
Mike Brown says... friend of the show, Mike Brown, he's been on the show once.
Yeah.
Says first R-rated, of Gotta Love Them Movies, if he still does that. He says first R-rated movie at home was Good Morning Vietnam. First R-rated movie behind my parents' back was The Matrix. I'm telling you, I think that's probably a lot of people's answer
watershed,
around our age.
Yeah. Watershed movie for people around our age.
Yeah. First R-rated movie in theaters, he says, it's one of these, and I honestly can't remember which. So it's either The Descent, Pan's Labyrinth, The Departed, or Sin City. One of those. I don't really remember which one. Well, I don't think it would have been The Departed, because that came out in, like, 2009, right?
The Departed was 2006.
Was it?
Oh, fuck. Yeah.
So if we're going chronologically... I think it must have been either The Descent or Sin City.
Yeah, I guess Sin City was 2004, so that I think that was even closer.
The Descent was around that time too, right?
Yeah, pretty close to around the same time.
You know, I like how sometimes we talk about this like we don't have a tab with IMDb open ready to go.
If only there was some sort of internet movie database.
And then finally, we have Dave Lindsay, who says, Clockwork Orange, yeah, I'm old. Not even sure it was technically R-rated in those days.
It probably was X at the time, yeah. Definitely earned it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So what was your, because so like Mike Brown, he answers first R-rated movie, and then the question specifically is first R-rated movie in theaters.
Yeah, so he gave us the whole gamut. Now, do you remember your first one?
So I think my first one not in theaters would have either been Aliens or Terminator 2. I think Terminator 2. Yeah, I definitely saw Terminator 2 before Aliens. And you know, it might have even been like on TV, so it might have even been like an edited version of it. So I don't know if that would totally count. It's hard for me to remember because my parents had sort of a weird way of censoring movies for me. Like, yeah, they wouldn't let me see. They tried to avoid like overt graphic violence. So sure. I remember like some, but I mean, they let me watch fucking Terminator 2. But like they didn't let me watch RoboCop. That one was very specific.
That's pretty violent.
Yeah. They also, I guess that's more violent than Terminator. They also wouldn't let me watch Universal Soldier. So like that was kind of the well, it like the very beginning of it, somebody like gets their hand shot off or something. It was usually gun violence. I remember catching a glimpse when I was very young, probably like 5 or 6, we were staying at my grandma's house and all the older kids were watching The Shining, but I was way too young. So they had me in another room with some of the younger cousins and stuff, and we were watching Aladdin.
But those, none of those movies that you were talking about were theater experiences.
Yeah.
Do you remember which one was the first?
Let me finish telling you The Shining story. So I was like sick or something, and I remember there was some reason I had to walk through the living room that they were in, and my parents didn't want me to look at the TV because it was too, you know, it was too scary. And I happened to walk through right at the scene where the blood elevator gets off. So it's like one of the worst scenes you could just randomly catch out of context as a 5-year-old.
The worst or the best, depending on how you look at it.
Yeah, yeah. But I think in theaters, the first one I saw... Okay, the first... The only memory that I can really... That's really popping out to me is my mom went through this weird Jean-Claude Van Damme phase when I was young. Like, okay. She had a huge crush on Jean-Claude Van Damme. So she watched all of his movies. And I got to watch a lot of them by proxy.
Sure.
It was great. She was so into Bloodsport and like The Quest and what's the other one that's basically just Bloodsport and The Quest?
The Quest.
Yeah, he did a few of them.
Did a few tournament movies.
Yeah. And I remember... And that was, it was during that phase that she rented Universal Soldier.
Okay.
But she watched that one without me because it was too violent. But Time Cop came out into the theaters around that time. And I remember, I think that's the first, one of the first ones I saw in theaters was Time Cop.
Okay. Yeah. I definitely saw that on video later. I think... Oh, man, this is actually kind of hard to say. No, it isn't. I looked it up online. The first one I saw was a reservation thriller called...
Native American Reservation?
Yes. Maybe it's Thunderheart. Okay. Yes, Thunderheart, starring Val Kilmer and Sam Shepard. Came out in 1992.
Two very Native American actors.
Well, yeah. It was about them being like detectives or whatever. I don't remember. But this was way, way back, way before the R-rated rule, I guess. Or they didn't know or they didn't care. But I was just kind of dragged along. Like, I was just the kid that they had to take to the movie because they wanted to see this movie for whatever reason. So, I mean, this is as technical as it gets because I remember nothing about it.
They were the top box office gross for Thunderheart.
Yeah, in 1992, there's probably a lot of buzz about it. I don't know. But, yeah, so I would have been 6 years old or 7 or something like that. So I definitely don't remember it, but I did look it up just to be sure, and it is R-rated. And I did see it in a theater. So I guess that counts. And it is technically a movie. Okay, let's go ahead and move into our movie news now.
Movie news. Talking about that movie news.
And we have a lot of backed up stories here since we didn't do it last week. So we're just going to try and power through these. The first big story is that James Mangold, who did the Logan movie, he is set to direct the Boba Fett side project movie. Now, I imagine this news and this deal was made before Solo, A Star Wars Story, kind of not did very well in theaters. So, I don't know. Do you think this is still going to happen?
Here's the thing. I don't think one sort of... I'm not even going to call Solo a flop yet. I don't even think that one poor performing movie is going to stop the Star Wars train anytime soon.
No, they'll probably fiddle with marketing before they do that.
Yeah, so I think, you know, we... Whatever Star Wars Episode 9 is still going to do insane numbers. And at this point, it's also just as much about merchandising and getting people to go to Star Wars Land when it opens next year. So I don't see them sort of cleaning slate on their production schedule anytime soon.
No. Unless the next one did just as bad or worse, I see them pretty much going forward with this.
Yeah, and I think the next one is going to be the Obi-Wan Kenobi standalone. I'm sort of into this. As far as all the standalone movies go, this one sort of has my interest peaked the most. Because we don't know... Are you still there?
I'm still here.
Okay, because we don't know a lot about Boba Fett's character or backstory, so, I mean, there's some clone shenanigan stuff, but there's a lot of blanks they can fill in.
That's my issue, is that if they're going to keep it in canon, like, I already think the prequels sort of ruined Boba Fett, but meh, whatever.
Well, yeah, but this, you know, this could be the chance to redeem him or whatever. I think that he is a character that is way less tied and beholden to the original trilogy than Rogue One or Solo. So I see the potential for this to be sort of the first real standalone Star Wars movie. So I think that could be cool if they go that direction. I think James Mangold, after, you know, my goodwill with Logan, I'm excited to see what he does next. So.
Well, he's done a lot of good movies. I just can't remember them. I think he, if I'm not mistaken, I believe he did.
He directed Walk the Line.
Okay, yes.
He directed other things that I'm pulling up.
310 to Yuma. That's watchable.
Oh, he did The Wolverine.
Copland, Girl Interrupted. Yeah, he did the first Wolverine, too.
Yeah. He's done some good stuff. I think he's done some good stuff within studio constraints. He seems like one of those directors that I don't think his best work has come out yet, honestly, except maybe Logan.
Maybe. Okay, let's move on. Zack Snyder says the Fountainhead is his next project. Of course.
Fart noise, vomit emoji. Don't care. I mean, I don't care about whatever Zack Snyder's next project is.
Generally.
Regardless. I see him working on fucking Ayn Rand being a total train wreck.
Well, it's going to be something. Now, apparently, I didn't know this, but his dream project for years and years was to do Atlas Shrugged, but they did that, like, three-part, pretty much direct-to-DVD trilogy not that long ago.
Yeah, man, fuck that. Before that, his dream project was Watchmen. I just don't think he's smart enough of a director to, like, adapt any form of literature, and I think Ayn Rand is problematic enough as an author that he's gonna focus on all the wrong stuff.
Yeah, I don't know what the right stuff is, to be honest, but yeah, you know, if people want to, I think a good place to look at the whole Ayn Rand argument is a John Oliver clip, Why Is This Still a Thing?
Yeah,
I think captured a lot of what I think about her and objectivism in general. Okay.
I agree. Not interested.
Yeah, and not interested in the slow down, speed up, slow down version of it either.
No. And the dumbed down, broed up version of it.
Mm-hmm. Jamie Foxx confirmed to play Spawn in Todd McFarlane's new reboot. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, I like it. If this Spawn reboot has any chance of taking off, he needs a star. Jamie Foxx, he's a star. He's a charismatic motherfucker.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. And, you know, as much as I love Michael Jai White and his roundhouse kicks.
Did he ever do a movie with Jean-Claude Van Damme? I feel like he should have.
I'm sure at some point they were in the same movie.
Yeah.
If not, that needs to happen real soon.
Yeah. Like, oh, fuck. That'd be... Oh, fuck Expendables. Give me Van Damme versus Jai White. Like, I'd pay pay-per-view for that shit.
Yeah.
They're just, like, roundhouse kicking the air at each other.
for 90 minutes.
Yeah, I'm into this. Like, this actually gives me more hope for the Spawn reboot than anything else so far.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How about the Crow reboot, which is doomed to failure? Jason Momoa exits. And I was always very mixed on the idea of, not even mixed, very negative on the idea of Jason Momoa as the Crow, because he's like a big, you know, he's a big muscular heavy dude in what's supposed to be this kind of like slender, like, you know, gothy, Robert Smithy looking character.
I don't think he necessarily even has to be like slender. I just think he's supposed to look like a normal dude.
Yeah,
he's not. He's not like a jacked up superhero. He's just sort of a guy. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, Brandon Lee was, you know, sleek and slender, and in the comics he was usually portrayed that way. But you know, he's one of those characters like Grendel, where there's enough iterations of the character besides just the original story that, like, you know, they could do something like that. But I don't think we needed a jacked up Jason Momoa version of it.
No, I don't.
Plus, I like Jason Momoa as an actor, but I think he's much better as a supporting actor than a lead. Like,
at least right now.
Yeah, and I just think, like, playing the Crow, he sort of has this swagger, and I think he's the kind of actor who needs to sort of play into that swagger, that personality of the actor. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it was ever really a fit, because the Crow is so dark and brooding. And you know what? I don't need a Crow reboot. The 1994 version is still basically perfect. So fight me on that, nerds.
No, I agree. But let's talk about how cursed this reboot is. They just cannot get it off the ground. At one point, Bradley Cooper was going to play the part, and then he became way too famous for that bullshit.
Right. And now he's a CGI raccoon.
And now, like, he should be. And then who is the bad guy who played Gaston in Beauty and the Beast?
Luke Evans.
Luke Evans was going to be him for a little while, and then
I could see Luke Evans. As far as most of the names that got thrown around, he was the only one so far that I've been like, oh, yeah, I could see that.
He's a guy.
I think he is tremendously talented, and I just think he hasn't had his breakout role yet.
Probably not.
But I think it's coming. I think he's going to be a Tom Hardy.
How do you feel about this? Jared Leto is getting that Joker movie.
I feel like I would rather sit on my own shit than watch this. Like, I would rather take a poop and have to just, like, squish my butt in it and go, look at me, I'm making a pie, like, in front of my entire office. I would rather watch Zack Snyder's fucking Ayn Rand bullshit. I will not see this. I do not care. I don't want it. Nobody wants it.
Nobody wants this. No. Agreed. However, I think if they did like a Joker Harley movie, there would be like a sect of like
people who weirdly uphold that relationship as hashtag relationship goals, or people calling them out online.
We definitely don't. I'm just acknowledging that audience does exist. The sort of modern Hot Topic teen, whatever that is.
The only thing that I think is remotely interesting about this news is because I believe they are also still in talks with Joaquin Phoenix about doing his Joker movie, right?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know about that.
I believe they're in talks to doing two different Joker films.
Well, that's right a fucking now. Mess.
Yes. But I think that maybe if these movies are trying to have some sort of conversation with each other about like the myth surrounding the Joker. Here's the thing. I don't think DC is smart enough or organized enough to pull something like that off.
I don't either.
And I think it's an extreme long shot. What if it was like the same movie? What if it was like a series of like Joker vignettes and they had like, here's the thing. These are the only ways I would have any interest in this. Is if there was like some sort of outside the box take on just a Joker
movie. Okay, now that I've let that sit in for a second, a Joker anthology movie would be kind of interesting, but
I don't think they should do it. I'm just saying I think that's the only way to even sort of salvage Jared Leto's Joker. Like, I don't even want to see it on screen again. I don't want to hear his stupid laugh. I kind of don't want to see Jared Leto again.
I'm very agnostic about Jared Leto and Jared Leto Joker. I did not. I think he was sort of the Jar Jar Binks of that movie, which is to say, not the problem, but the symptom.
Yeah. But no, I agree with that. But I think that it was sort of a 1-2 punch between his Joker and him borderline ruining Blade Runner 2049 for me. That was like, oh, I'm over Jared Leto. Like, I'm done with
it. So him. Over Jordan Catalano.
Yes.
Donald Glover and Ryan Gosling are.
And Ezra Miller. He didn't make the headline, but right now they are the three front runners to be playing Willy Wonka in Paul King's Willy Wonka adaptation, the director of Paddington.
Right, and I think we talked about like if there was any way to do Willy Wonka again in a way that's not completely tired and bogus, it would be that director. So I have a little bit more faith. I don't know if I really feel one way or another about any of those choices. I feel like they're all popular, slightly quirky actors.
So I heard a rumor. I don't know if it says this in this article.
Uh-huh.
But I heard that this movie's supposed to be a prequel to the first Willy Wonka, which if that's the case, done. I don't want it.
Yeah.
I'm done with it. I don't need it to connect to anything. I don't want it to be a prequel.
You don't want
a reboot or
the Willy Wonka movie universe?
No. No. I don't want movie universes. I just want a movie. That being said, if it is its own thing, I could be into either the Goss or the Glove. I'm not into Ezra Miller. I just
little young.
He's just I liked him in Justice League, but I don't really know him yet. He's not a known quantity to me yet.
I'm a little bit more familiar with his work, I think, because I've seen more of his indie stuff. Most notably, We Need to Talk About Kevin and After School, which were sort of the movies that kind of made him a thing. And he's a really talented actor, and I think he has that kind of enigmatic, you know, he could, in a way that's not gross to say, he could be this generation's like 1993 Johnny Depp if he wanted to go that direction.
I can, yeah, I mean, everything you're saying tracks.
I'm not really into the idea of a super young Willy Wonka, and I don't know. I don't really feel one way or the other about any of these choices so far. Like, none of them is like a, oh, of course, kind of.
I have a weird relationship with Donald Glover.
I think a lot of people do.
I like Donald Glover. I like all the things he does. I even like his music. I liked... But there's just something about him that I just sort of hold him at arm's distance. Like, I don't fully embrace him.
Yeah, same here.
And I there's something about him that just seems a little cynical and a little calculating to me.
Agreed.
In a way that I think sort of removes him from anything I've seen him do.
Yeah, I feel no matter what I've seen him do, I've never seen it never feels like he's 100% committed. Like, he's always...
Yeah, and maybe it's because he does so much, and he does it well. Like, you know, he does stand-up, he does sketch, he does movies, he does a... I haven't watched Atlanta, but I've heard it's amazing.
I've heard it's music good, too.
His music has gotten really good.
That's the thing about him I like the most. Like, if he was just Childish Gambino, I would see, like, I would get, quote-unquote, get Donald Glover. But... Donald Glover, the Bo Jackson of multimedia, eh.
Yeah, I'm not going to say eh, because I do get it. Like, I thought he was the best part of Solo. I thought he was great as Lando. Man, did you see his SNL this year? I think it's one of the best SNLs they've done in years, and I'm a fan.
I've seen a couple.
I genuinely enjoy SNL still. But I thought his episode was so fucking funny. So I get it. I just, it's not like an instant yeah for me. I believe he could do it, but he doesn't necessarily excite me.
Yeah.
Them all, you know what I'm going to say.
I think I do.
Give it a Gosling.
All right, let's go ahead and move into the movie reviews, and we'll start here with last week's Hereditary. I'll set this up. This is a horror film by first-time feature director Ari Aster. He did a few shorts. I looked him up after I saw the movie. But this is his first feature, and it stars Toni Collette and Gabriel Byrne. And Toni Collette has just recently lost her mother. She sort of had a pretty weird, estranged relationship with her mother. She kind of took care of her towards the end of her life.
Are you talking about the movie now, or is this backstory?
No, this is Toni Collette's character, Annie, recently lost her mother.
I was like, wait, she did? Why the fuck would she do this movie?
She was taking, the family was taking care of the sort of matriarch of the family, and it was not a very ceremonious passing on, because everybody had a strange, weird relationships and feelings going into it. So that's where the movie starts. Kind of starts with this shroud of grief and family bickering and problems in the air. They have a daughter played by Millie Shapiro, making her on-screen debut, named Charlie, who seems to be a little quirky, we might say, a little on the spectrum, we might say. She was the only one who was super close to her grandmother. And, oh man, I do not know how to go far into this.
Okay.
Into this.
Yeah.
I'll say this off the bat. I think Hereditary is the type of movie that is better the less you know.
Yes. Okay, before we get into it, you said, I'm going to see Hereditary this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I don't want that. I'm not a fan of horror movies in general. Like, I'm not a fan of this particular type of horror movie, specifically, like, demons and things in the corners and popping out at you and booze and that.
Yeah.
I don't like haunted. I don't like modern haunted house movies. I don't like modern possession stories. I think they're tired. I think they're played out. I saw the trailer for this and was like, and it was a big fat nope for me. And I was like, Cassidy, I want to see Ocean's 8. And you were like, fuck you, it's my podcast. I'm going to see the scary movie and you're going to have to see it by yourself. Because I know Ashley's not going to want to see it. So you're going to have to go to a fucking dark ass theater on a fucking Sunday matinee and watch this Spooksville show all by yourself. And I said, Cassidy, no, don't do this to me. And you said, fuck you. That being said.
Might have been the subtext of our conversation.
That being said, this movie's so fucking good.
It's real good. And there's a couple things to say about it. If we're talking about expectations, I knew that it was being released by A24. If this had been a Blumhouse deal or whatever, I probably could have skipped it too. But I had an interesting cast, and I could tell the cinematography was like better than normal based on the trailer. And it was getting rave reviews out of the festival circuit, and A24 put it out. And when the horror they're releasing right now is, I think, the best stuff since the 70s.
Yeah, did they Get Out, right?
No, actually, that was a Blumhouse deal. But they did The Witch.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so they might have had Roadshow Attractions did The Babadook, but there is this kind of indie horror renaissance happening of the last five or so years.
And I've noticed they're all coming out in the spring. Don't trust the fall releases. But the spring releases seem to be where it's at.
Spring or sometimes winter. I think The Witch was released in like a beginning of the year almost.
I still haven't seen that one.
But anyway, so when I saw that, I was like, oh yeah, that could be good. And then they released the movie out in, I think, England first. And I was seeing some early chatter on Reddit. And a lot of people were saying, like, yeah, the people who hated The Witch and It Followed are going to hate this one. Which made me just want to see it more because I liked those movies. But then I was it kind of put me in this idea. I was like, oh, okay. So this is going to be, like, super subtle. And it's going to be, like, maybe stuff is happening. Maybe stuff isn't. And people don't like ambiguity, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And then I saw that it got a D+ cinema score. So then I was like, oh, for sure, that's what's going on. A cinema score, we should say, so people don't confuse it with, like, critic reviews. Cinema score is just snap reactions from the audience as they're walking out of the first couple screenings.
Whereas on Rotten Tomatoes, it has like a 93%. So critics have been loving it.
So audiences. That had me prepared to believe that this was going to be like kind of a subtle art house horror film. This is a fucking horror movie with a capital H. And I don't understand like the people who saw this and said, oh, that's just a drama with some thriller aspects.
I agree. Okay, here's the thing. I think as far as scares go, it was just right. There's no jump scares, first of all.
There's a few jolts.
But it's different than a jump scare. It's not a pop out at you, make you go, ah. It's not scaring you by being fast and loud.
No.
It's a very clear framed shot where you're focusing on one thing and then you see in the background and go, what the fuck? Why are they doing this to me?
Yeah, this movie really, really, really ratchets up the tension. It's two hours and some change. And it takes its time. And maybe that's what people don't like. I don't know. But it.
I think this is what would have happened if Kubrick. If Kubrick had directed Rosemary's Baby or The Exorcist.
Okay, going into that, this I said, you know, I already mentioned 70s horror once in this. This movie is almost a love letter to 70s horror.
Yes.
It's all over the place.
Ari Aster has such a boner for The Shining. If he didn't do it so well, it would be frustrating.
Well, there's specific shots that reference The Shining. There's this whole motif in this movie about the mother. She makes like these dollhouses or these maquettes. She's sort of an artist or whatever. And she bases
makes
it,
miniatures, yeah.
Miniatures or shadow boxes or whatever you want to call them. And he does this thing where he shows the house or certain shots, frames the shots a lot like he does the miniatures, mm-hmm. which plays into this whole idea that the family is being manipulated.
Yes.
And like a doll in a dollhouse. And also it's a reference to, I think, the Shining shot where we have, I think it's Jack Nicholson's character looking into the maquette of the maze. And then there's that cool dissolver, however he did it, the way it goes
fade into the actual maze. I think it's worth noting too, that the Overlook Hotel that they built for the climax of The Shining that explodes, it was famously done with a miniature. Mm-hmm. That's such like well-known behind the scene knowledge that I think that yes, her profession was definitely purposeful as both a storytelling device and as like a reference to The Shining
and just in movie making in general.
As far as tone goes, I think it also is the closest to The Shining. Like it sort of just slowly builds this unrelenting tension until sort of all hell breaks loose,
Similar to The Shining. It's also sort of sequenced similar, where we have these kind mm-hmm. of these chunks, these like these large extended set pieces or these family conversations, and then it kind of switches very quickly from night to day to sort of usher you into the next part of the movie in a way that The Shining has those like title cards that come up quickly.
Yes, yeah. So I have a question for you. When you saw this, did people laugh in your screening?
It was a very active audience. It was packed. So even though this movie like had like a crummy cinema score, it's still doing pretty well, especially for its budget. But it people I think had, there were a few gasps. There were a few kind of giggles, but I would say appropriate giggles, like they were just sort of relieving the tension.
Yeah. So I saw this on a Sunday matinee, and the theater was, I mean, it was like half full. It was pretty sparse. I had a whole row to myself, which did not help my feelings at all. It seemed like everyone in the theater was just sort of on bated breath until this moment at the end where people started laughing. And I think it was just a tension release because it is so damn tense.
Yeah.
I think as far as like audience participation, it was just me. At certain points, I would audibly go, "What the fuck? No. I don't want that."
There's like two or three scenes in this movie that are, you know, besides the fact that I think it's an effective horror film and is scary, I think this movie is scary. It isn't just like cool and artsy and cerebral. I think it is viscerally scary.
But it's not. It's
for
not
me, for me. I know that that's very subjective and da da da. But I think
it's not a lot of. It's not a lot of schlock scares though. Like it's not overly gory. It's not overly violent. Like there are some moments of violence, but it definitely knows when to.
I mean, the violence there is though is pretty for real.
Yeah.
Like there is like two or three like gut punches in this movie, and I'm not. And again, this is. I wouldn't even say they're like horror in the typical sense. Gut punches, like, but there's these moments in the movie that like. Borderline traumatized me.
I'm not gonna say it because I don't want this review to be spoilery, and I don't think we need to. I think we can talk about it without
getting revealing into stuff.
But there's a moment where I went, oh, I fucking love this movie, when just like the complete unexpected happens,
mm-hmm.
and I was like, okay. Like up to that point, I was like, where is this going?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what is even happening? And then I was like, oh, fuck. What?
You're talking about the inciting incident.
Yes.
Yes.
Up to that point, the movie didn't really have me. I was like, okay, it's taking its time. There's a couple little spooks.
Mm-hmm.
There's definitely some mood building. There's some ennui. Is that the word?
No, but there's some creepiness in the atmosphere for sure.
Yeah, and just like the sense of dread, and then it. It's a real good movie.
Yeah, and it's beautifully shot. Every scene is, you know, very low lit. I'm glad I saw it at a good theater that knows how to project movies, because I feel like this would have definitely had the same problems that Solo had for some people, where if your projectionist is dimming the bulb for some reason, it's going to just look murky. But
yeah, because there's a lot of low light shots mm-hmm. that depend on you focusing on something that you don't notice right away.
Right, for sure. He uses his frame.
That's what I fucking... Yeah, the cinematography of this movie is so fucking good, because it was like, there's a very clear focus, and then the shot is just long enough for you to see something and go, no.
Yeah, no, agreed. And it holds its cards pretty close to its chest. I will say there is a moment where the movie goes from anything can happen. Like, it almost was so scary because it was like, because I didn't know what was going on. And then there's a moment where there's a little bit of an exposition dump towards the last third. And it's, again, it's very referential. Almost every 70s movie has this. This is, you know, this is the moment when Wendy is going through the all work and no play pages. This is the moment when, you know, Rosemary's Baby, when she finds out. I mean, it's that moment. And this has one of those. And then I would say the pressure valve kind of releases a little at that, because I realize, oh, okay, we're definitely in a tropey horror film now.
Yeah,
And I don't mean that in a bad way. I think we're having fun while we're there, but
then no. And honestly, I think I was glad that the movie digs into it, because there's definitely a point where it's like, where it could just be that certain characters are losing their minds and stuff. And there's definitely like some metaphor at work there, like the way we process grief and things like that.
Oh, for sure.
But I was glad that at the end it was like, no, this is fucking real and fucking horrible, because that actually helped settle me as an audience goer. Like the ending, I was like, oh, OK, it's a movie. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
It's a good ending, but it
as a horror film. This is a mean one. This movie is like one of the, you know, pretty close to one of the bleakest films I've seen in a while. And it is not holding the audience's hand as far as like, you know, this is the time to go get the popcorn. It's time to go use the bathroom or something like that. Like it's a movie you got to kind of pay attention to. And it also is full of really terrific performances. Alex Wolff, who plays their son, is really good in this and has a lot to do. He's kind of a newcomer. He was in My Friend Dahmer.
He was in the new Jumanji too, I think. He was a pretty small part in that because The Rock plays him for most of it.
A lot of people are already talking about Toni Collette. They're even saying Oscar buzz. I'm not so sure, but, you know, weirder things have happened. She's very good in it.
I think if this movie had come out in August, yes, definitely 100%. I think it's going to kind of depend on how award season goes.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't surprise me, because she
might get a nod at the very least. Yeah. And Dowd, who is like one of our great character actresses, she's really good.
She has she replaced Margot Martindale?
I think they trade off every other year.
Well, so Ann Dowd, she was in The Leftovers. She was fucking great in that. Had kind of a similar vibe going on.
She's in Handmaid's Tale.
It's like, I feel like she kind of snuck in on Margot Martindale, on her territory. But yeah, she's fucking great. My only real complaint as far as cast goes is,
I think I know what you're gonna say,
the dad.
Yep, he is the weakest link.
he's I think a little too old, and here's another thing that bothered me, and I know this is might be dumb, but both him and Toni Collette are very white, and Alex Wolff is not. He has some kind of a more ethnically diverse.
He looks Mediterranean. Features. I think he was in My Big Fat Greek Wedding Part 2. So
you know. Sure. So I was, and the only reason I point this out is because I was during the movie trying to figure out their relationships. I didn't know if the dad was like a stepdad or his biological father, you know, because he doesn't look anything like him.
And I think Gabriel Byrne is a good actor, like generally, but in this movie, he feels like he's in a different movie. And maybe to an extent that's intentional, because he is kind of a little bit more removed from the, you know, what's going on in Toni Collette's mind, da da da. And he's supposed to seem a little distant, but I think he's too distant. I think he's too erudite. He doesn't feel modern in the way that the rest of the movie does.
I agree. He is like the only thing that really sort of marked this movie down for me. I just felt like everything else was so meticulous that his casting seemed a little just out of place. I don't think he was terrible.
He's fine. It's just, but it's not what I see in that role, especially given that one of the biggest is talking about parenting and talking about children's relationship with their parents and like how one parent might relate to a child more than another. And that he's supposed to have this relationship with Alex Wolff that is unlike the relationship he has with his mother. And I feel like he just so doesn't belong in that family that I have a hard time getting that dynamic.
Exactly. It was always like just never totally clear. I mean, it was other than textual references, other than what's actually in the script, it wasn't really clear to me that they were actually father and son. And that's what I was trying to figure out. I was like, and I wonder if that is intentional. You know, maybe there is something to be said there about that distance. I don't know. It made me want to watch it again, though. Like knowing all the
what twists the deal and was turns with him. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Just to see if there's other stuff I pick up on. But I liked, like I said, I don't really like horror movies like this. Normally movies more like Annihilation are my jam.
Right.
So you mean
paranormal horror?
Yes. Yeah. I don't think I've seen a movie that involves like demons that I've liked since the 70s.
This movie is so steeped in that aesthetic. I mean, there's obvious references to, you know, especially structurally and the way it's shot to Kubrick and The Shining, but there is a lot of The Exorcist in this movie. There is a lot of The Omen. There is a lot of Rosemary's Baby. There is a lot of even the original Wicker Man and Don't Look Now.
Yeah.
And like that era of horror, that kind of cerebral, more, you know, the new Hollywood horror is what this movie is referring to.
Yeah.
And it's pretty, pretty great. And again, I just want to stress, I don't understand the people who say this is not a horror film. What the fuck is a horror film to you? One of the main motifs of this movie is decapitation.
It's not like a date horror film. It's not stuff's going to pop out at you, so you have to cling on to each other kind of
horror. It's not Unfriended to the Dark Web.
Exactly. It is a patient.
It's not The Purge.
Ominous, brooding, like you said, mean fucking movie that requires patience and attention. And that is not necessarily what a lot of audiences go to movies like this for, which is exactly why I avoid movies like this nowadays.
But I didn't find it boring at all. Like I even with a movie like The Witch, which I adored.
Sure.
And I could watch that and go, I get why this isn't for everybody, but I sure love it. But this movie, I think, has enough of like traditional horror enthusiasm that I'm like, I think this is horror enough. But I think
horror audiences are so different now than they used to be. And I think that when you and I are watching this, we're watching it from the lens of film criticism, where we're like, ooh, that's a Kubrick move or whatever. Whereas I think most audiences are like waiting for the monster to jump out.
For sure. For sure. But I didn't watch this with just a critical cerebral.
No, I agree.
I was genuinely
I agree. For like the first 15, 20 minutes, I was watching it like that. And then there was enough shocks and dramatic movement for me to be punches. Like, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, stuff I did not sign up to see.
Yeah. Like, no, for sure. For sure. But that's what I mean. Like, I think that I do know that a lot of audiences were going expecting that type of a movie.
Right.
And, you know, I think expectation does have something to do with it. I was expecting to be miserable, but I was, but in all the right ways.
In a good way. Yeah. Miserable in a good way. That put that on your poster. It's not a pop horror film. It's not an extreme horror film. If you allow me to be super annoying, in my quest to compare all horror films to different types of heavy metal, this is more of a doom metal. This is a funeral doom, maybe.
Okay, you're done. Yeah, I will say, I think this movie, just to compare it to like other modern horrors that I've seen that I've enjoyed,
mm-hmm.
this movie did not scare me as much as It Follows.
Really?
That movie still sticks with me. Like, I still think about it sometimes.
I think this is way scarier, but I enjoy both movies a lot.
Here's the thing. It's the ending. The ending did so much to sort of relieve that from me, in a good way, in a totally like, it's totally bleak and on genre, and there's enough pulp and camp that it pulled me back down to, oh, this is make believe, if that makes sense.
Right. You're able to kind of put it in its context cinematically.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Whereas like It Follows, I didn't get that sort of sense of relief.
See, I love It Follows, but I thought that was like a big love letter to Carpenter and a little bit to Wes Craven.
But I think it lingers a little more. I think there's less resolution with that movie.
Maybe.
And that's why I think it kind of stuck to me. I think comparing it to Annihilation, I got a similar sense of like bleakness and nihilism.
And dread.
And just feeling weird afterwards.
The film school graduate in me, who's always looking for a paper to write. I would say that there's sort of a similar theme.
That's what blogs are for.
That's what blogs are for. There's sort of a similar theme we see here in this and The Witch and, a little bit in, Annihilation. This kind of the deconstruction of the American family.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know exactly what there is to say about that, but that seems to be explored right now, in these types of films. And I love this movie. I thought it was great. It really fucking freaked me out. I'm going to say that, like, I left the theater and I saw it late at night. So I only had like a couple hours to decompress before I saw a
Sunday matinee. I got to watch a few hours of The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt before, you know what I mean? Like
to chase it.
I had time to sort of compress it and stuff. But that being said, I'm not going to say that I haven't woken up in the middle of the night to use the bathroom and like checked the corners of the room.
Scurry down the hallway as fast as possible. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, oh, fucking.
And I think it's good in that way, as well as also being really smart and beautifully shot and well acted and all of that stuff, too.
Yes, I agree.
So I give it an A-.
That's what I gave it. The only minus was just for that little snafu of casting.
Agreed. Yeah.
But yeah, it's so good.
Very good.
See it without knowing.
Yes. Hopefully you didn't even listen to this review because again, I think the less you know going in, the better. It's not a pop horror film. Let's go ahead and get into the Netflix homework, Train to Busan, and I'll let you set that up.
Okay. So, this is South Korea, right?
Yes.
We're in South Korea. It is a little girl's birthday. She wants to go and visit her mom for her birthday. She's living with her father, who lives in Seoul. Her mom lives in Busan. They're going through a divorce. And so her dad is like a corporate man. You know, he's working really hard to make a good life for her.
Always checking his watch.
Yeah. Always checking his phone. He's a stock trader, right? Something like that.
He's a
businessy.
Suit. Yeah.
Yeah. But he agrees that he's going to take her to Busan, for her birthday to see her mom. Once they get on the train, it seems that a zombie outbreak has occurred. An infected individual manages to get on the train just as they're boarding.
Mm-hmm.
And then, basically the rest of the movie is just, can they survive this hellish train ride filled with zombies, and can they make it to Busan, where it's theoretically been liberated by the government?
Yeah, it's safer there, or it's been barricaded or something.
Yeah, there's some military presence.
Yeah, lots of stops along the way, and we see lots of evidence that the zombie outbreak is spreading very rapidly. I mean, this is like 28 days later. Different levels of
infection.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is not a type of thing where you can hide the fact that you're a zombie, like, for long periods of time.
Yeah, these aren't the sort of droning, they're like the fast,
rabid runners. And you know, I'll say this about Train to Busan. I don't know if you agree, but I thought I was pretty much done with zombie movies. I'd heard positive things about this, but, I didn't know how a movie could really do it in a way I haven't seen it before. And I think this one kept me pretty excited. This is, I would say, a little bit more of an action movie than a horror movie, but, it is.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly gory.
It's certainly gory.
You know,
and it's really,
it's not on like the zombie gore scale. I don't think it's, I think it's less gory than like an episode of The Walking Dead. And actually, that's something I wanted to bring up, was something that I enjoyed about this movie was there's this sort of cliche move in zombie movies where once the zombie outbreak has caught up with all the characters, once they know what's going on, and they start like fighting back against the zombies, they know they're not regular people anymore. It seems like in most zombie movies, all of a sudden your main characters are sort of endowed with sort of this superhuman strength.
Right.
And they're like able to crack skulls and bust heads, and like pop zombie heads off with bats and stuff. And something I enjoyed about this movie that I thought was refreshing was how sort of ineffective the characters were. Like, they were able to sort of fend the zombies off, but they weren't really able to kill any of them. They weren't really, you know what I mean? Like, they couldn't just swing a bat and crush a zombie's skull.
I think they managed to get a couple along the way, but it is like, and it's something that you don't see in that many zombie movies. It seems like, yeah, humans are overpowered and then zombies are almost underpowered. It's like these things are just as hard as it would be to kill a person, which is to say.
Yeah, exactly. And so that,
not super,
I think,
easy.
was a refreshing take on the sort of the zombie lore is that, oh, these are real people and they're dealing with real bodies.
Right. And lots of them. And, you know, they're being hoarded, which we've seen in some movies before, too, but never in such a small, contained space. And, you know, there is even, like, one of those sort of might have been homage, I'm not sure. It could have just been, you know, the most effective way to shoot the scene. But there's even a scene that reminded me of the hallway sequence from Old Boy when they're going through the train.
Cool.
Yeah, when they have to
kind
of power through.
I really liked that character. He was badass.
Yeah, Mae Dong-suk, I believe is the actor's name. He kind of plays the badass of the group, but he's also relatable. He's not just a badass. And
at first you think he's kind of a prick, but he's actually calling out the main character for being a prick.
Mm-hmm. Lots of great characters.
Yeah, there are. So one of the things I'll say about this movie is I don't think it does anything really new. You know what I mean? Like, I think it follows the sort of formula of a zombie movie pretty closely, pretty beat by beat. Like, it's not looking to reinvent the wheel. But I will say it's pretty effective at what it's trying to do. Yeah, it's a good zombie movie in a genre that's pretty played out at this point.
Mm-hmm. I was gonna say it's very efficient. It's like a no fat kind of movie. Like, you get to know all the characters really well, and well enough to care about them and just to distinguish them. And you know, they're put in this kind of tight situation. It has a little bit of a, you know, speed with zombies kind of vibe to it.
Aside from like sort of the end set piece, they probably could have filmed this pretty quickly and pretty cheaply, because most of it does take place on this train. Mm-hmm. So very limited sets, but it doesn't feel cheap. It feels like...
No, I wasn't thinking about budget a lot.
No, but it was one of those things where it was like I was watching it and I could I noticed these moments where I was like, that's a really efficient way of doing that. Like, oh yeah, you know, they shot a whole day in a fucking tiny bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
But they also had to be pretty creative with sort of the way the characters dealt with these situations too. Like the part you were talking about that kind of reminded you of Old Boy sort of kicks off this long sequence of these characters having to get from one end of the train to the other.
Right.
In a bunch of zombies in between is like on paper. I think that could be a frustrating premise, because it's like, okay, they just, you know, how are we going to make each car sort of different and make the character's progression interesting and dynamic. But I feel like they're able to do that very well.
Yeah, no, I agree. I never felt like the movie was kind of off.
Yeah, it didn't feel like it was stalling or filling anything. It felt like it was a pretty efficient movie.
Agreed. I would say even if you think you're done with zombie movies, you've seen them all, I think this is a good addition to the genre, and I think it's really entertaining. Like, there's enough. It's not just miserable. It's not just like gore all over the place. I mean, there is some, but it's also a good like disaster film or a good action film too.
Yeah, I think if you're into zombies, definitely check it out.
Oh, for sure.
If you're kind of over zombies, I think it's. I think it's pretty easy to be jaded towards zombies right now, because they just dominated popular culture for like 5, 6, 8 years, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they're kind of we're kind of getting away from that now, which I think is good. But I think this is a solid one to add to the canon.
Yeah. So what did, I should leave in a little space here. Mike Fallick, when we had our technical issues, he dropped in a short, hot take on this movie. So I'll play that real fast.
To be honest, I mean, I'm recording right now and maybe you can just play this. I thought Train to Busan was a great movie. I have very little to say about it, to be fair, just because I thought it would, I mean, I'm sure I would enjoy talking to you two about, I guess you're not talking right now as I'm recording this, but it's a great movie. It's a pretty good zombie movie. If I were talking with Keith and Cassidy, I'd probably go on about, Bullet Train, which was a great Sonny Chiba movie, also Asian Train movie, which influenced Pelham 123, but not really. I'd probably ask them about train movies and things like that. It's a good movie. That's all I can say. If you want to drop this 2-minute thing in, go ahead. Otherwise, it's a very good movie. Probably not going to be a zombie classic, but a good movie nonetheless.
What did you have for us next week?
Next week, we are going to be watching the Scientology sci-fi cinematic experience, Battlefield Earth.
Yes, which I was hoping would be added eventually, because I told that whole story about how when I saw it as a kid and the movie burned up about half an hour in and never saw the end.
Oh, I'm so fucking excited for something that I know is going to be terrible, but was trying its best not to be.
Yeah, maybe it's so bad it's good. What if we love it? What if we love this movie genuinely and we're like, this movie's underappreciated?
Well, then we can
die on that mountain.
Yeah, we can become Scientologists and jerk off John Travolta. I'm sure he'd appreciate it.
I'm sure he would. Okay, so that's what we got for this week. And if anybody has any opinions on anything we talked about, whether it be Hereditary, if you happen to catch it, or Battlefield Earth or Train to Busan or anything we talked about here, you can contact us at our email, jabberinthejerone@gmail.com. You can also follow us on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Player.fm, Pocket Casts, the Windows Podcast Network, and Google Play is where you can stream us. And you can also follow us on Twitter @JabberPodcast, follow us on Instagram @JabberPodcast, and follow us on Facebook @facebook.com/JabberPodcast. I just started uploading reviews again to my blog, so go read those over at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. I most recently reviewed the horrifically awful direct-to-Netflix movie Ibiza because I needed something to review. So I just did the last thing that they uploaded. And it is so bad, I don't even want to acknowledge it on this podcast. But you might You might have fun reading it. Okay, so what's your stuff?
You can follow me at Keith Foster Kid on Twitter. You can follow me at Keith Foster Kid on Instagram. Go to my website, www.keithfosterkid, for show dates. My last show, last couple shows, I just had a show in Hemet, California, which is like kind of, it's like out in the fucking middle of nowhere desert.
It's like Inland Empire, I think, maybe.
Yeah, it's like a half hour away from Palm Springs. Oh. They actually reference it in an episode of Love.
Okay.
It's fucking, man, I could just like smell the meth when I rolled into town. It's just like, it is like a Breaking Bad. It reminded me of like Pocatello, but if Pocatello was in California.
Is it as bad as Barstow? Because I think that is a pretty depressing town.
Barstow's pretty shitty. Here's the thing. It's not that the town itself is like, you know, for being in the middle of nowhere is like pretty and stuff. It's just I got that fucking small town meth vibe like the moment I rolled into town. But
all right.
The show was actually really good and they really liked me. So I might be going back to Hemet at some point.
Unless I hear this.
Yeah. Nah. I mean, we were like making meth jokes. They know who they are.
Okay.
And then this week, I've got one last episode. What's the word? Episode show of the improvised Western at Book Club this Saturday at Old Town Improv Company. Come check that out. Starts at 9 o'clock. It's a really cool show. This month we've been doing Western. Our last show went really well. I'm really excited for this show. And then I think I can announce this. I don't know. I'm going to. On June 22nd, I will actually be back in hometown Pocatello, and I'll be Ashley and I will be performing with the Comedy Project on Friday, June 22nd at 8 p.m. I don't know. It used to be the Gateway Theater. I don't know what it's called anymore. I think it's Messina Price Dance Studios. It's on 2nd Street. Go to the Comedy Project. You know where it is. Yeah, so come check that out. Friday, January 22nd.
January?
June. June. It's June?
Yes.
It's June.
Okay, be sure to listen to all our friends out there who also do podcasts, including Rod and Denise, / Rod and Moksha, Rod and Guest, over at The Listening Party. I did a podcast recently with Patrick over at Almost Educational.
Actually, you guys inspired me to delete my Facebook app off my phone.
We didn't even talk about that, but okay.
Yeah. I mean, I still have my Facebook account. I deleted the app.
Okay. You should also be listening to Patrick's Make Dad Read Comics, the show he does with his father. And you can also listen to Bill and Brian over at the Great Albums Podcast and Mike Fallick over at Hack Thought, and Buddy and Alice at Those Happy Places.
Also check out Adam Connie's podcast, The Adamant Podcast, and my friends Marilyn Bow at Campfire Shit Show. But that's shit with no I.
All right. Talk to you later. Oh, I hate you.